boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for tuning in. This is Red Ice Radio. The website is redicecreations.com. I'm Henrik Palmgren from Sweden, and this is independent internet radio dedicated to listening and learning about the hundreds of different topics that we are interested in and cover on the website, but also to question that material and re-examine it along the way as we seek answers. You know, a common mistake people do is that they make up their mind before they hear about the research or look further into the material. Usually this is done because of an, you know, invested interest. The argument might be painful and simply difficult to deal with, but confirmation bias is very common and very difficult to keep at bay. So we do the best we can to hear out new information and new angles, and then make up our mind accordingly. And this is what we hope our program can do for you as well. You know, keep an open mind, but not so much that you're brain falls out and continue to question, and I think we're off to a good start. Today we are talking with Christopher Bolin. He's an American journalist, now living in Sweden, who has investigated the events of 9/11 ever since they occurred. He is with us to discuss his book Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World. And there's an upcoming event in Sweden where Christopher will be speaking as well, and we'll talk more about that throughout the program, but let's get started and get to it. Hi, Christopher. Welcome to the program. Thank you for being here. It's nice to speak to you. Hope you're doing well today.
Hello, Henrik. It's nice to be with you.
Definitely. Now, let's talk a little bit about the groundwork here before we get into talking more about your upcoming event, your book, and everything else you have ongoing right now. Maybe you can tell us about your relationship to 9/11. I think most people that we actually talk with on this program have something to relate according to how their research changed after that point, what they got into, even how their lives changed to a certain degree. When did you get into 9/11, and what's your story there, Christopher?
Okay, well, I was an investigative journalist. I was a working journalist at the time, working for a little newspaper in Washington, D.C., and I happened to be passing through New York City with my family early in the morning of 9/11, about 2 o'clock in the morning. We were driving right past Manhattan with the World Trade Center on the left-hand side. When it happened in the morning, we finally found a hotel, and when I got up in the morning and I saw what had happened, saw the second plane hit and saw the Pentagon get hit, then I realized I couldn't go to Washington because that would be locked down. And we drove back to Chicago, where I'm from, on a smaller road through Pennsylvania. But I realized right then this event was going to change my life, as an investigative journalist, I suppose. But I knew it was such a massive history-changing event that I knew it would change my life.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Now, when did you is this your first book you've written on 9/11, Christopher?
Yes, what I wrote is I worked as a journalist, as I said, and I wrote about September 11th as I investigated it from 2001 all the way through to 2012. And in 2007, I was attacked by undercover police at my house outside of Chicago, which led to a corrupt process, a trial. I was found guilty of having attacked the undercover police and resisting their arrest. And we left the United States and came back to Europe. My wife happens to be a Swedish citizen. And that's when I started writing the book, because I knew that I had to present my information, my analysis, and my research in a concise and easily readable format that people could take with them. So I wrote the book, Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World. And that contains a thesis. And all the original articles that are behind the thesis are printed in a second volume called Solving 9/11, The Original Articles. And these two books are actually a set, Solving 9/11 set of books.
Very good. So let's just kind of dive into it, I guess, here, Christopher. There's just a tremendous amount of points and information and data surrounding 9/11. But in your view, how do we solve 9/11, and what are some of the biggest key components that you've focused on here?
Well, a big part of my research is the cover-up, the concealment, the cover-up of the crime itself. And this is, in fact, a crime, because the cover-up of 9/11 involved the destruction of the evidence, the confiscation of the evidence, the obstruction of justice for the relatives, and the fact that there has been no 9/11 investigation, criminal investigation, nor has there been a proper trial for any of the alleged suspects or anybody that was involved in any way. So we have an uninvestigated crime, and that's what many people really don't understand, because they've seen the reports from FEMA, they've seen the 9/11 Commission report, they've perhaps seen the NIST study. And these are all federally appointed commissions that looked at various aspects of the of, for example, they looked at how did the buildings perform prior to the collapse, but the collapse itself they didn't look at, and you know that there was no investigation, because rather than investigating the evidence that was left behind, you know, for example, the steel at the World Trade Center, the FBI under the supervision of Michael Chertoff at the Department of Justice, they simply allowed all the steel to be recycled, sent to New Jersey, chopped up in little pieces, and sent on boats to China. Well, that's not a criminal investigation when you destroy the evidence.
That's right.
And this cover-up by Michael Chertoff, you know, he was an official. He was the Assistant Attorney General at the Department of Justice. His responsibility was to prosecute the crimes of 9/11 because they fell under his purview, in his domain. Terrorism being a federal investigation, FBI was in charge of the investigation. The FBI is a sub-agency of the Department of Justice. Well, the FBI went around confiscating evidence and allowed the evidence to be destroyed. So there was no investigation. So these people, the people who ran the FBI investigation, Michael Chertoff, are culpable. They're responsible for the destruction of the evidence. So, you know, if you want to start your investigation with the crimes that are most easily prosecuted and where the culprits are most easily identified, you start from the cover-up.
Definitely. So maybe you could give us a brief outline how you today see the event, how it's gone down from planning to carrying it out to the actual cover-up of itself. And then later, of course, mm-hmm. we can get into a little bit more of who actually is responsible in mm-hmm. your view and the bigger kind of geopolitical chessboard, if you will. But, how do you see the event?
Okay, how I see the event is quite different from the way the government has presented their narrative. You know, the government presented a narrative whereby Osama bin Laden and his group of 20 Arab terrorists committed the atrocity and committed all the destruction and carnage in New York and in Washington and in Pennsylvania. I, on the other hand, from my research up into the history and the deeper history of this event, I found that, you know, the Mossad, the former head of Israeli intelligence, his name is Yisr Harel, he had predicted precisely such an event happening in New York City in 1979. And in 1979, he told a visiting American Jew who was very, very close to him and people like Menachem Begin and people from the far right Likud coalition. He told this American Jew that terrorism will strike New York City and that the Arab terrorists will strike your tallest building. And so then, you know, that was in 1979. Then go forward to 1993 when we had the first bombing in the World Trade Center, where a truck bomb went off, which was created by the FBI. You know, the FBI created this kind of car bomb and was playing very, very closely with the culprits who they alleged, you know, did it. And the bomb went off and the whole world thought, oh my God, Arabs are trying to blow up the World Trade Center. Then go forward a few more years to, 2000, and we have the Project for a New American Century saying that, we want to have American forces in the Middle East on a permanent basis in countries like Iraq and Afghanistan. But in order to do so, we need something like a new Pearl Harbor. Then 1 year later, after that report was written, we have 9/11. We have the event. And, you know, before the towers even collapsed, just after the planes had struck, we have Israel's former Prime Minister, Ehud Barak, on the BBC television in the studio in New York, in London, telling the world who he thinks did it and who what he thinks the United States has to do. He said that we know that Osama bin Laden is behind it, and he said that we know where he lives, that is Afghanistan, and then he called for a concrete operational war on terrorism and said for the United States to lead this coalition into Afghanistan. And as you know, we've been there ever since October of 2001.
Yep.
And Swedes and Norwegians and Danes and Estonians and, you know, what they call the coalition of the willing, they're all there. And so, you know, that raises, you know, when you understand that 9/11 is a deception, then you have to ask yourself, well, is the Swedish foreign ministry, is the Swedish defense ministry, are they deceived or are they going along with this deception? You know, is it sort of like going along to get along or are they deceived?
Yeah. What do you think in that case?
Well, I think it varies from player to player. You know, like in the case of Sweden, you have Carl Bildt, who is the foreign minister and a very powerful man in the Swedish government. You know, I think that he may very well know some of the truth, and he goes along because he's part of the team. You know, he's very close to the Bush family, and the Swedish papers not so long ago reported that Carl Bildt is a CIA agent. I don't know, you know, but there seems to be common knowledge in Sweden. But so he may know, but other people, for example, in other positions in the Swedish government, in the Danish government, in Norway, what have you, some are deceived, some believe the U.S. version, and some probably don't believe it, and some may very well know what happened. What really happened?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you're right. The whole world has been drawn into this theater afterwards that consequently have ravaged the world ever since, and it keeps on expanding. All the policies that we've seen in terms of the expansion of Big Brother and surveillance and wiretapping and all these things is always, we go back to 9/11, we blame that. That's the reason why the whole world had to change, right? So it's our obligation to continue to examine these events and continue to look at them and make the government that asks us to go along with all of this, we have to continue to examine them and have them present us with evidence, right, so that we can make sure that this is really how it happened, so that when we give up our freedom, that this is not for something which was a false flag, something that actually, you know, was had a very different intention behind it. So, I mean, that's the obligation here in this case, right, that we have to examine it.
Yes, well, If we accept the false narrative of 9/11, then we're accepting a false narrative of our history. We're basically accepting a false history. And like they say, he who controls history controls the future. And you know, that by controlling the history, by writing this false history and putting us into this false predicament where we are now challenged and fighting against Islam and Russia, but you know, and fanatic Islam and the whole Muslim world, by putting us into this kind of dilemma, predicament, they enslave us. So you see, that's like what George Bush says. You know, you're either with us or you're against us, or you're with the terrorists. So, you know, these foreign ministers in countries of NATO countries and around the world, they said, well, gee, you know, I don't want to be with terrorists, you know, so I better be with Bush. So that's how the Bush administration was able to form this coalition, because it was like gangsterism. That's the kind of thing that gangsters say to you on the street, you know,
yeah.
You're either with us or you're not. And if you're not, you know, you're dead. So, you know, countries like Switzerland and Sweden and Norway, which have been neutral. You know, Norway was neutral and during the Second World War it was occupied. But here, you know, a few years, you know, in 2003 and 2004, you have Norwegian boys over there in Afghanistan, you know, as snipers, shooting Afghani people in their own country. And you know, you say to yourself, wow, how did things change that much?
Yeah.
Well, that's the deception. So by understanding and explaining to others how we have been deceived, we empower ourselves and we protect ourselves and we protect our society and our nations. Because, you know, for example, the soldiers that were fighting in Iraq, the American soldiers who were in Iraq, 85% of them believed they were there because of 9/11 and Iraq's role in 9/11. Well, there was no Iraqi role in 9/11. There's not one stitch of evidence that Saddam Hussein or any Iraqi had anything to do with 9/11. But you see, that's how the propaganda works. That's how the military works. That's how the media works. And you know, by insinuation and by calling, you know, they call their biggest camp over there in Iraq, they call it Camp Buka, after one of the firefighters, I think, who died on 9/11. So in the mind of a soldier, he was there fighting because of 9/11. Now, if those soldiers understood that 9/11 was a farce or a hoax or a scam, what call it what you will, it was a deception, and that Iraq had nothing to do with it, they would certainly have to reexamine why they were in Iraq. And it's the same holds true for Afghanistan.
Absolutely, Christopher, you're right. Now, let's go back a little bit and put this in another kind of context as well here and look at, because as you said, the whole world has been drawn in, but I think no one has been at the tip of the spear, at least as the physical role, if you will, in this as America. And you have, I think it's chapter 3 in your book, you have a really good chapter that details how America has been the target for, not only 9/11, of course, but also Israel's history of false flag terrorism. And this would put things in context a bit as well, so people can understand that this just doesn't come out of the blue and this starts a tradition that never, ever before has existed. There is a long-standing history here. Maybe we can just run through some of these.
Yes, yes, absolutely. There was the false flag terrorism, and terrorism was perfected as a tactic, as a strategic tactic of war by the Israeli terrorists or the Zionist terrorists in Palestine in the 40s. For example, they blew up a hotel. A very similar event is they blew up the King David Hotel in July 1946 in Jerusalem because the British authorities had gone on a mission and they had arrested a lot of the Israeli Zionist terrorists. And they had found evidence that the Jewish agency was involved in terrorism. Now, the Jewish agency is like the core body of Zionism. And when they had found this evidence on an operation called Black Sabbath, the Brits had information that would have taken many of these Zionist terrorists to the gallows. They would have been hanging. And so what the Israeli the Zionist terrorists did was they said, well, the British have all that evidence. They've got the goods on us. They've got us at the King David Hotel. We've got to blow up the hotel. And so they did that. They killed 90 people. It was one of the worst acts of terrorism in the Israeli-Palestinian struggle ever. But it's very, very similar to 9/11 because the same sort of thinking was going on there because there was a lot of evidence of crimes, Enron crimes, gold crimes, many financial crimes that were being held in the buildings of the World Trade Center that were destroyed on 9/11. But this false flag aspect is when one party, like the Israelis, commit a terrorist crime or some sort of atrocity, like the bombing of the USS Liberty, the attack on the USS Liberty in 1967, and then try to blame it, design the attack so they can blame on their enemy, like the Egyptians. And that's what they wanted. That's what they wanted to do in 1967 when they attacked the USS Liberty, which was a spy ship, like an NSA type ship, off the coast of Gaza. The Israelis attacked it. They attempted to sink it with all men on board, and they hoped that the blame would be passed on to Egypt. They did a similar thing in Egypt in the 1950s called the Lavon Affair, where they took nitroglycerin bombs into buildings belonging to the British government and the American U.S. government. Cultural centers, libraries, diplomatic buildings, movie theaters. And there again, they hoped that the bombings would be blamed on the Egyptians and would cause a divide between the government of Nasser and the U.S. government. But one of the terrorists, his bomb went off in his pants or on the way to one of his targets, and he was caught. And he confessed and he exposed the whole thing. He named everybody. And so after that, the Mossad learned that from now on, agents only know as much as they need to know. So if they're caught, they can only confess to a small part of the crime, not to the whole crime.
Hmm. Yeah.
So the Israelis have done this several times to the United States, to Britain before in the past, and it's worked before. But this time, you know, because of the atrocity, it was so big, and they pushed it too far. They went too far. And they didn't expect that people like Professor Jones would discover nanothermite in the rubble. And when that nanothermite, that hermetic material, was found in the dust of the World Trade Center, that was really the final nail in the coffin of the official version.
Let's see here. I mean, obviously, I don't think too many people listening to this program believes that Osama bin Laden was involved in 9/11. But nonetheless, that's what we've been told. And you know, as we know afterwards here, then Osama was caught, he was killed, his body was dumped at sea. All right, good. You know, problem solved, right? But so let's examine your angle to this and tell us more about Israel's and the Mossad's involvement in 9/11 and what you found, what some of the, you know, the clues are here that points that this is who the guilty party is.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I said, Yisr Harel, the former chief of the Mossad, the founder of the Mossad, made that prediction in 1979. And then some of his Mossad men, some of these older guys who were involved in, for example, kidnapping Adolf Eichmann from Argentina, these old Mossadniks, I call them Mossadniks, these fellows were involved in trying to get the security contract for the World Trade Center in 1986. So this is like 7 years after Yisr Harel made this prediction. Here we have his men, people like Zvi Malkin and Shalom Ben-Dor and Shaul Eisenberg of China, the big Mossad guy in China. These guys were trying, they had created a company called Atwell Security, and they tried to get the security contract for the entire Port Authority, which is, you know, the subways and the World Trade Center. But the World Trade Center was the crown jewel of the Port Authority. And if they had gotten this contract, then they would have had, then Mossad, this Mossad company, Atwell Security, owned by Shaul Eisenberg, the big Mossad operative of China, then they would have had the security contract for the World Trade Center already in 1987. If that had happened, I think 9/11 would have happened earlier. Much earlier, maybe a decade earlier,
right?
Because they were putting the pieces into place on the chessboard. But what happened is that somebody at the Port Authority discovered that Shalom Ben-Dor was a murderer and a criminal who had murdered a couple of Palestinians in a bus hijacking episode in Israel back in the 80s, and he had these men killed in cold blood. And so that led to a scandal at the Shin Bet, which is the sort of like the internal security service in Israel. And, you know, when this was discovered that he was the guy who was going to get the security contract for the World Trade Center, some wise person at the Port Authority said, no, we're going to nix this contract. This is not going to happen. And so the contract was torn up or was prevented at the last minute before it could go into effect. Well, what happens then, these two characters, these Israeli Mossad guys, instead of, you know, they weren't going to just say, okay, it's not going to happen. They sold their services and they went to work with American Jews who were involved in the World Trade Center, people they could trust, and they created a new company. Then it became Jules Kroll Associates, Marsh McLennan, you know, the... Mm-hmm. This group of people that happened to be the office where the first plane struck.
Right.
This was Marshall McLennan. This was their office, and the first plane went into their secure computer room. And at the time of 9/11, they had the security contract for the World Trade Center, a group called Kroll Associates. And this group is very closely tied into the AIG, the financial failure that happened later. The same people are involved, and the second plane then flew into a second secure computer room in a Japanese bank in the South Tower. So, but the company Kroll Associates They had a security contract for the World Trade Center, and they got it immediately after that bombing in 1993.
Right.
And they revamped security for the towers, and they became in charge of security, and they had security all the way through. And they had people like Jerome Hauer who worked for them, and they had been involved in all of this, and security of the towers is essential for such a conspiracy, because you have to have access to the building at night, in the daytime, and any time. When you control security, you control who gets in, who gets out, what cameras capture, what cameras don't capture, who's working in the core of the building, who has access to the elevators, all that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a big part of it. Specifically, then, if you think about how, you know, certain things were of course put into the building itself, but then we cannot nestle out of the situation in terms of how the military, for example, managed to stand down the planes and the hijackings and everything else. How do you think they pulled this off? And do you concur that there were drills going on at the same time as this unfolded to kind of confuse things? But what is the interface here with the military, if it's true that they managed to get them to stand down here?
Okay. Well, that's a very good question, because it's what we do know is that 9/11 was also a very sophisticated computer crime, and that there was a little Israeli Mossad computer company, enterprise software company, in Quincy, Massachusetts, called PTEC. And PTEC was a company that wound up having its software on all of the computers in the U.S. government, in the U.S. military, in the House of Representatives, in the White House, in the FBI, you know, the IRS, you name it. PTEC software was running on these computers. And PTEC was working with another company called MITRE, which is basically the engineering and software company for the U.S. Air Force. And these two companies were working in the basement of the FAA, looking at how a crisis would, like 9/11, would be communicated between FAA and the military. And so what we had on 9/11 is, of course, we had these games going on, Vigilant Guardian and several other games in which they were actually playing hijacking games. You know, planes are being hijacked, bombers are flying in from Russia, and the computer or the air traffic controller, for example, in New York, upstate New York, they had on their computer screen that morning, they had not only the planes that were actually in the air, but they had what are called false injects, false inputs. They had planes, they had dots on their screen that did not really represent planes, because they were false inputs into the system. So that when the crisis happened, and they knew that they were, you know, day two of this game and day three of this game, but they were doing a hijacking game, and so these people would say, well, is this real, or is this part of the drill?
Yeah.
You see? So the confusion, and then they had to remove the false inputs from their screen. And to what degree they were successful in doing that, but the air traffic controllers were thoroughly confused. And so the fact that they were doing a drill, and the fact that they were false inputs on the screens, meant that there was a delay. That there was a delay in the time, from the time that these FAA aircraft controllers should have contacted the military. But then, as I said, this little Israeli Mossad company, PTEC, had been in the basement of the FAA looking at this interoperability of these systems in the event of a crisis between the military and the FAA, what have you. So in that way, as enterprise software, you know, shows, you can see what is going to happen in real time on the network for any enterprise. So they'll say, well, then this communication will go here, down channel A, communication will go down channel B, and communication will go down channel C. So they just have to stop, or stop those communications, and it won't go through. Because they know, you see, the 9/11 crime was very, very sophisticated. One of the people who investigated it from the U.S. government said the only thing it resembles is a very sophisticated Soviet plot. Well, you know, because that's what he was used to looking at, such a sophisticated plot. It was in years and years in planning, and every single aspect of it had been prepared for. And then, so that's what happened. So the access to the computers, and then knowing what the computers were saying to each other, knowing what the people were going to do at the FAA and the military, being in a position where this little company and people associated with this little company were basically in super user, had super user abilities on 9/11. That means they can stop communications or they can give false communications, what have you.
Interesting. So it's a backdoor kind of thing there in terms of the computer system. That definitely seems to be part of it nonetheless. How many people and companies or firms do you think would have to be involved in to be able to pull something like this off, estimately?
Well, there's quite a few. There are quite a few companies involved, you would have to say. But then again, the compartmentalization of knowledge. For example, the people that made the thermetic material, for example, the people that made this explosive thermetic material that's like a paint, well, they might have been prepared, their material might have been prepared for the U.S. military, or might have been prepared for some other military. Those people would not necessarily know they were preparing this for an evil conspiracy to kill thousands of people in New York City. The people who put that in the building, there again, they might have been tricked, but they were spraying a primer, a kind of a paint that hardened and became an explosive paint. But did they know that? Maybe they thought they were applying some sort of rust proofing or some sort of, something to do with asbestos. They might not have known that was actually a very sophisticated explosive. And so on and on and on. But what we have in such an event, there are three levels of planners. There's the architectural level planner. They're the ones who plan the event basically to change public opinion. So those are the guys at the top. Those are the Henry Kissinger types, the Benjamin Netanyahu types, the George Bush, the father of George Bush, that level of architectural planner. Then there's the management planner, the management level. They're the ones who manage the operation, people like Michael Chertoff, who are there at the Department of Justice, ready to do what has to be done to prevent the truth from coming out. And then you have the third level is the working level. And like in a case like this, any of the terrorists who applied the paint or any of the so-called Arabs who were on the planes, if they were on the planes, they're part of the deception. But that's the working level. And so you have to understand that it works like that. So what we need to do is we need to prosecute the crimes of 9/11, investigate, have a proper criminal investigation, and find those management level people. We know the names of many of them already, and we have to find those architectural level people, and they have to be prosecuted for crimes of mass murder and terrorism. It's as simple as that. We're not reinventing the bicycle or anything. We have to do that.
Do you think they chose September 11th, 2001 for a specific reason, or was this just the first a day, if you will, that where all the pieces of this puzzle were fitting together, and that's when it happened, kind of thing?
Well, that's a good question. I think that in such an event where there is so much, so many layers, like these vigilant guardian games going on, knowing who's going to be in charge of the air command on that day, who could be here, who's going to be there, where George Bush is going to be, where Dick Cheney's going to be, where people are going to be. They have to have it pretty well figured out, I would say several weeks in advance, and they have to know exactly which day it's going to happen. So I think that the 9/11 date was probably known some months in advance, and they probably chose it because of, the 9/11 dialing system in America. If you need help, dial 911. It could have some numerology associated with it, too, I know, but I think they probably knew that date, planned that date, penciled it in, and confirmed that would be the date because they have all the things, all the ducks kept in a row. Everything has to be ready. And they do it. That's when they do it.
What do you think about the hijackings? Who was part of that in terms of actually being on the plane? We have a BBC article coming out afterwards with obviously the majority of the hijackers being alive and well, despite their, passports being found around the sites and everything else. But what do you make of that?
Well, early on, I contacted the airlines because, these Arab hijackers' names were not on the passenger list. And their explanation for that was really not satisfactory. They said something about how they had needed to have approval of the next of kin or something like that. No, this was not the case. I don't think that those people, those 19 hijackers, were on the planes that hit the buildings. But then again, I don't think that the planes that hit the buildings were Flight 175 and Flight 111. We certainly know there was not a big 757 or 767 that went into the Pentagon. We certainly know that it didn't go into that, one of them didn't go into the hole in that little field in Pennsylvania. But we do know that there was something that shot down over the woods in Pennsylvania. And so what they may have done is they may have put all the people on one or two planes and then consolidated them onto one plane and then had that plane shot down over Pennsylvania. That seems to make sense to me. I don't know if that's what really happened. But, you know, if those 19 Arabs were really on the plane, then they would have been captured on video footage. There would be documentation of them, passing through clearance at the airport. The passenger screening at the airport was done by another Israeli company, Israeli or International Consultants on Targeted Security. And this company is a Mossad company, an LL/Mossad company. This company was the one that was checking the people's, the passengers getting on the planes in Boston and Newark and the other airports. Now, if this company had evidence, if they had solid evidence, if they had videotaped footage of these men getting on the plane, going through, security check, we would have seen it. But we haven't. So I really don't think that, and like you said, many of these suspects, these alleged suspects, they had been issued duplicate licenses in Florida. They had lost their passports in years previous, which means that somebody else had a copy of that man's passport. Somebody else had a copy of that man's driver's license. So in a classic Mossad operation, somebody was going around with, for example, Mohammed Attar's passport or driver's license, leaving a false trail of clues. And this is the kind of clues that came out later. Oh, he was at a strip club. He was drinking vodka. He was doing this. He was doing that. Because somebody else was laying a trail, a false trail, for the suspect. And so this is part of the Mossad game. If you've ever read a book like The Little Drummer Girl about how the Mossad operates in Germany, it's a very good book by John le Carré. But that's what they do. They leave a false trail for the person they intend to frame.
Yeah. Now, do you think that there were any, Muslims or Al-Qaeda, part of the operation to any extent, meaning that they thought they were part of a drill, but they were actually being set up as a sting operation or anything similar to that, or was it all Mossad handling it from start to finish?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. I mean, I've heard, some people think that it was originally a Muslim operation, which the Mossad then infiltrated. I know there's a man at BBC, a former journalist named Hart, who says that. No, I don't think that's the case. I think that it was a Mossad operation from the beginning. One has to understand that the Mossad has infiltrated every opposition Arab group and every Arab group in the Middle East. And they've
created some of them as well, by the way.
Precisely. They created Hamas in order to make a divide between the Palestinian community, between the more religious Muslims and the more secular ones in the Fatah. So that's what they do. They I think that they created this. Obviously, the idea, the intent, was in the mind of Issa Harel in 1979. So then they just create the entities or the groups or the cells that are going to take the blame for this. And all these characters have to do, these Mohammed Attars or whatever, if to whatever degree that they're involved. They just have to be in a certain place at a certain time, or they have to do this or do that. But it was not their idea at all. They were just patsies. completely. You know, like Lee Harvey Oswald, just complete patsies. People who fit the profile, who were cut out to be the suspect, and then blamed.
So the event has consequently been pinned on Al-Qaeda specifically. In some cases, people, you know, put a parallel between Muslims there as well. And they were drawn into this as being the guilty party, despite the history that we have between the U.S. and the creation of Al-Qaeda when it comes to fighting Russia in Afghanistan. But tell us a little bit about the bigger picture there and what you see the main purpose of this was, to be able to draw, as we said before, kind of the world into this greater conflict. But again, a lot of this has obviously been focused around the Middle East, try to secure, you know, Israel's position there and everything else. Is that the main driving force behind that, or is there anything, not that that's important enough, of course, but is there anything else in that picture that we could add to it?
Well, yeah, there certainly is. You know, the root of all evil, they say, is money. And, you know, money is the one thing that is definitely behind this as well. You know, ever since 9/11 happened, the U.S. defense budget has doubled, more than doubled, from about $300 billion a year, which is about $1,000 for every man, woman, and child in the United States, to twice that much, and more than twice that much. For a war in Afghanistan, which is a place that most Americans have never been, which was a country that was completely unable to even speak for itself when it was blamed after 9/11. I mean, so, you know, what they were able to do with 9/11 is they were able to infuriate the American population and the world population to such a degree that they would acquiesce in anything the government wanted to do to fight this terrorism. Because, you know, that's what, you know, Congress then passed a bill called the Authorization to Use Force, which gave George Bush the authority to use military power anywhere in the world to fight this menace that had struck New York City and Pennsylvania and Washington that day. So they are now using that authority to use force all over the world. I mean, they have an operation going in the Caribbean. They have an operation going in Africa. They have operations going in Asia and Middle East, everywhere, even the United States of America. So it was meant to create a new zeitgeist. You know, it was to create a new era. We had finished the Cold War era in 1990, 1991. The Russian threat, the Soviet threat was gone, and the U.S. military industrial complex, they wanted to have a new war, a new enemy. And they, you know, for years they created this. They planned this operation against Iraq for years and years, and they prepared the operation in Afghanistan. They had made threats to the government in Afghanistan just several months before. I think in July 2001, they told them, you will either accept our carpet of gold or we will carpet bomb you. Yeah, I mean, this is the way these people do business.
Yeah.
You know, as we see from Victoria Nuland, her recent comment about, you know, F the European Union. This is how these people talk. And, you know, Victoria Nuland is the wife of Robert Kagan, who's the man who brought us the Project for a New American Century. He's the one who brought us the surge in Iraq. He's the one who brought us the war in Iraq. He's the one who called for a new Pearl Harbor. And see that his wife is now, you know, fomenting a new war in Ukraine. How is it this Kagan family, you know, of Lithuanian Jews who, you know, really don't have very many smarts about them, how is it that they are dictating U.S. foreign policy? Come Republican, Democrat, Bush, Obama, it doesn't matter. They remain. This is our problem.
Yeah, that's really interesting point. And of course, it's interesting you bring Ukraine into that picture as well, because it's something that continues to expand these kinds of conflicts and the way that they ravage countries and change them from within with revolutions. And we have, you know, the Eastern Bloc countries with the, you know, the color revolutions and everything else. That's been another kind of scene that has been fought in a different kind of way for many, many years as well. So that's an interesting point. But before we continue and carry on with this conversation, Christopher, and talking more obviously about the involvement of the media, I want to get more into the cover-up itself. There are just so many components to it. Let's take a break, but before we do that, let's talk a little bit about the upcoming event that you have in Sweden here later this month, and it's I believe it's one of the first kinds of the events that actually occurred in Sweden. It's in Jönköping, about mid Sweden. It's at the city library, the Stadsbibliotek, right there, the 24th of February to be exact. Tell us a little bit more about the event, Christopher.
Yeah, well, it's it's the idea of think globally, act locally. I want to share information. You know, like I said, you know, the consent of the government of the governed means nothing if the people are not informed. So what I want to do is I try to share information with the public, with the people. And for a long time I thought, well, I didn't want to really try to bring this material and push the material on to the people, the local people here in South Sweden. But actually, there's a lot of interest, and I have a lot of supporters in Sweden, and people here are really interested because, you know, the media here in Sweden is very much like the media in America. It's pretty much one-sided like a toothbrush, and you don't read about these things, 9/11 truth, or you don't hear about them in the media. So I'm speaking at the local library. They have a very nice auditorium, seats about 180 people. And I hope they have a full house there. I'm going to talk about the books, and I'm going to talk about, you know, how 9/11 has changed our history and what we can do to reclaim our history. Because if we can't reclaim, you know, some sanity to our historical narrative, then we're lost. Because then if we allow them to tell us our own history, if we allow these criminals to write our history for us, then we are their slaves. And that's what they want. They have no sympathy for us. And so we have to inform ourselves, because only by informing ourselves can we resist their tyranny.
Absolutely. And again, this is something that, you know, Sweden has been part of and involved in for a long time, even our own wiretapping program, the FRA law that was passed was it 2008 or something like that, or maybe even earlier, I can't remember now, but nonetheless, the incentives or the reasons given for this was 9/11, mm-hmm. We have to, you know, stop terrorism, et cetera, et cetera. All everyday life of Swedes are even affected by this event. That's why it's, important to put that into the right context. But tell us where people can find out more about, you know, more information about the event. Where do they pick up tickets and such, Christopher?
Sure. Well, the entry, the tickets are only 100 crowns at the door, and it's in the basement. It's in the cellar of the Jönköping Library, which is in the middle of Jönköping, which is really the middle of South Sweden. It's south of Göteborg, and it's south of Stockholm. It's like on a large lake, but it's south central Sweden, and for Sweden, it's quite central, so people can come from the coast or from other towns, you know, in Skåne or further north, and it's at 5:30 at night. It's going to be from 5:30 till 7, and I figure that I'll talk about 45 minutes and present my material, and then I'll have time for questions and answers, because there's a lot of people have a lot of questions about this, and I don't know how much the Swedes know about 9/11, because, you know, like I said, we did the European tour back in 2005, but nobody came to Scandinavia. But on the other hand, in Norway, my book was translated into Norwegian, and it was one of the best, most read torrent downloaded books in Norway. So there's actually quite a bit of awareness in Scandinavia.
Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that. It's about time. Give us the website then, where people can find out more about the book, pick up copies there, and also read more about the event then.
Sure. It's my last name, which is Bolin, B as in boy, O-L-L-Y-N, Bolin.com. So it's a very simple website, www.bolin.com.
And, of course, more information about the book there as well, Solving 9/11. We'll have that linked up and provide some more information as well to that. But, all right, Christopher, we'll take a short break here then. We'll carry on in the next segment. Stay with us, everybody. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. We pick up in the second hour to talk more about 9/11 and the context of the geopolitical chess game as we proceed. We discuss the media control in Sweden, but also abroad. We discuss Russia and the control of the satellite states to the old Russian Empire by the oligarchs. We talk about revolutions, color revolutions, military interventions in order to keep perpetual war and conflict going as a means to keep control, not only of the Middle East, but in the extension of the world. So much more coming up. You can hear our continuation on our members' website, redicemembers.com, where we have our entire archive of shows going back to 2006 in place. If you're a new listener, we can let you know that we have no commercial interruptions in our broadcast or any sponsors or ads on our website. So this is how we can continue to produce material, 3 shows per week. That's around 6 hours of radio per week. So if you like what we do and want to hear more, please sign up for a subscription and show us some support, and we can continue to expand in our productions and bring you more material. We have a lot more coming up on Red Ice Radio. Barbara Peterson, Karen Hudis, Konpop Yuyen, David Icke, Ulla Damegård, Brian Forrester, and L.A. Marzulli, and many more. You'll find our full upcoming guest list in the radio archive. We will, of course, be back in just a few days with more radio, so you can tune in then. But we'll carry on right now then with Christopher Bolin in the second hour. The website is redicemembers.com. We'll see you there. Thank you for listening.